previously on the history of America's 1%.
With the labor movement vanquished and the workers beaten down once again, the alliance of convenience between the middle class and the robber barons was dissolved. The Vanderbilts and other wealthy families quickly resumed their domination of the nation's industry and natural resources, while the middle class rekindled their war against the industrial magnates, who they saw as a threat to the small fortunes that they themselves were trying to amass. Hastily, antitrust laws lobbied for by the middle classes were passed by Congress and the states, all in the hopes of protecting their ill-gotten gains from the vulture-like magnates. By 1890, 23 states had passed antitrust laws. But it was all for naught, as the magnates quickly found technicalities within the law, and any time the trusts were broken up, they quickly re-solidified structure deeper in the technicalities of the law. And meanwhile, in Pennsylvania, the Philadelphia and Reading Railroad had secured over half of the great coal deposits in that state, and it was now that two dynasties joined forces to plunder the Philadelphia and Reading Railroad and divide the spoils of its coal mine holdings. And they were the Vanderbilts and J.P. Morgan.
You get up and howl about America and democracy. There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today. We no longer live in a world of nations and ideologies. The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome back once again to another episode of the History of America's 1% podcast, the series where we dive into the long and shadowy history of America's ruling elite through the works of authors who were either silenced, suppressed, or forgotten to discover the origins of the 1% and from where their power and wealth was, and still is to this very day, extracted. And I want to say Happy New Year to everybody. Welcome back to 2000, or welcome back. Welcome to 2016. This podcast is back. I want to say thanks to all the people who sent emails and left messages on the website. I appreciate it. Everything's fine. Just life gets in the way sometimes of our hobbies. And that is what happened to me. And the holidays didn't help very much. Either once we get around to about November, it's a whirlwind in my neck of the woods. So, thanks for sticking around. I hope It hasn't been too long, and you guys remember where we were on the last podcast, because I certainly had to go back and do some reading. But yeah, for the last 30 episodes of this podcast, we have been reading a book. The book is called The History of the Great American Fortunes. It's published in 1910. It was written by a man named Gustavus Myers, a self-taught author, historian, and researcher. I don't believe he had any formal training in this area, but he was, I guess he considered himself at the time a reformer. He wanted to know what was going on in America, why it was going on. He went into a library and came out with this book, which was quite it was a tough nail to swallow back then, for sure. And a lot of rich and powerful people didn't like it. His manuscript sat unpublished for a decade. He finished this at the turn of the 20th century, so 1900, I think 1901 maybe. And it sat unpublished for a decade, and then in 1910 or 1911, the only person brave enough to pick it up was the Charles H. Curran Company, cooperative of Chicago, who at the time was the largest publisher of socialist pamphlets. They took the book, they published it, and they prayed, I would assume, because they were expecting backlash and libel lawsuits, you name it, the works. They expected to have the literal book thrown at them, because the people who Myers wrote about were very rich, very powerful. The people who controlled the politicians and the judges and armies of lawyers, big businesses. I mean, they were literally the 1% of the time. And here he was writing about all the crimes they had committed to get their fortunes. And yet, nothing really happened. No lawsuits. The book was, well, too well footnoted, I would say. He did his research quite well, and the facts were on his side. And to this day, I don't think anybody has disputed what Myers wrote. Now, they didn't ban this book. They didn't have to. They just ignored it. It got some bad press, and for the most part, it went away. You probably, if you go into a library, or especially if you're on a university or college campus, this book is probably sitting there in your library. It probably hasn't been checked out for a while, but it's still around. You can get copies online. It's not like some rare book. It's just not very well known, because, well, this stuff is not taught in schools, and this book is certainly not for consumption by the American public, because, well, there's a lot of inconvenient truth in this, I have to say. So, yeah, that's pretty much it. I think last year we were able to pump out 18 episodes of this podcast, or I was. It's a one-man show here. So, this year I already have 13 episodes sitting and waiting for editing. I think we're going to be able to get through a lot more, because you know what? It's not just this one book, which in itself is a mighty tome, over 700 pages in tiny type, three volumes. But I have more and more books on the 1% and how they kind of developed and evolved over the course of American history. Now, Myers has so far done an excellent job laying the groundwork, all the way from colonial times up to, we're into the 1890s now, late 1880s, 1890s. And for the last five or six chapters, we've been looking at the Vanderbilt fortune. Last time we looked, J.P. Morgan made a quick cameo when he joined forces with the Vanderbilts, I think third generation of Vanderbilts, and they divvied up the vast coal mines of Pennsylvania when they took over the Philadelphia and Reading Railroad. And what a lucrative venture that was. So we have one more chapter here about the Vanderbilt dynasty before we'll be moving on to a different pasture here, and then we'll be taking a look at the Gould fortune. So yeah, stick around. It's going to be, as always, I always say, it's going to be interesting if you like this hardcore history type stuff. But this is real, and the thing is, I think this is now probably more important, not more important, but as important as it was when Myers wrote it. At the time, the world was about to go through a great upheaval. People could tell, I would say they had known for 20, 30 years, there was a swell that something was wrong in the country. You had a few men gobbling up everything, swindling everybody, and really taking over the machinery of government. And I think we're kind of at the same point in time now. I think a lot of people can look around and see that something's not working right, or something is gone astray with the system. And we feel that we're at a precipice. And I think the beauty, the importance of this book that Myers wrote is that he went back through history and looked and found that despite what they teach you in school or what you see on the History Channel and those great documentaries that they do up, things have always kind of been this way. You know, the good old days in America, they weren't really that great. And it's kind of depressing, but I think it's important that we get our heads wrapped around this, because otherwise we'll have somebody come along, a leader who will have all the solutions, and they'll just lead us around in a circle right back to where we were before. And we've seen that happen time and time again in this book, where, oh, we just need a law, right? We just need to pass a law to make everything right. I'll just give you a quick example off the top of my head right now. People have been talking for the last couple years about, oh, we need to reinstate Glass-Steagall and that'll fix everything, or that'll be a good start to fixing everything. If there's one thing you can learn from this book, it is that no law is going to do anything at all, because the people who write the laws, the people who make the laws, the people who enforce the laws, and the people who invalidate your laws are the exact same people that you're usually trying to punish with the law. They are the 1%. They make the laws. They write the laws. Myers has said 100 times that the law was the greatest asset of these people. It wasn't their money. It wasn't their holdings. It wasn't their railroads. It wasn't their trusts. It wasn't their corporations. It wasn't their gold. It wasn't their natural resources. It was law. Law was their greatest asset. It is what sustained them through centuries in this country, and many centuries before, all the way back to the monarchs with the golden crowns on their heads. Law, law, law is what they wielded as their weapon. So, I mean, and that's just one little thing. I hate to hammer on that right now, but that is just one little aspect of this book that is so important and to the situation we face today. I feel like that is, I mean, once you get that through your head, you'll look at everything differently. You'll look at the people who watch MSNBC or Fox News and say, oh, we need to pass this law, or oh, we need to get rid of that law, and that'll start fixing things, and then we'll be on our way to prosperity. My friends, it's not going to be a law that changes things. It's got to be us. So, anyways. Okay, here we go. Let's get into it right now. I'm not going to waste any more of your time. I know you didn't tune back into this podcast to listen to me ramble on. Let's talk about the Vanderbilt dynasty, shall we? I forgot to do the format. As always, and just as a refresher, I will try to keep the recording down to about 1 hour in length for easy digestion and consumption of the material. I will be reading the book just as it's printed. I'll only stop to offer my interpretation and insight wherever I feel it's needed. We're not just trying to do rote memorization here. Sometimes it helps get the brain flowing when we talk about stuff. And on the same note, feel free to go on the website, leave a comment, give me your interpretation of the material. You know, I don't mind that at all. I like hearing other people's perspectives. I'll also be interrupting to spell any last names, give definitions of any archaic words, and also I will be reading the footnotes from the book. Now, the book has a lot of footnotes. Some of them are just citations. If it's simply a citation, I will just say, you know, here's footnote number one. And then you can go onto my website, fileandclaw322.wordpress.com. You can find the post for the podcast, and I will have all the footnotes linked up there so you can go check the sources. Now, if it's something more than just a citation, I will actually read it into the book, because sometimes Myers likes to go on and he likes to expound upon a subject in the footnotes. I mean, sometimes they're half a page, three quarters of a page. Sometimes they run multiple pages. And we have found some absolutely brilliant little nuggets of wisdom and some great facts in these footnotes. And it would be a crime if I left them out. And I know there's other people who have done recordings of this book, but I think that is one thing that has been sorely lacking from them. So I'm throwing them in there, and I hope you understand. So without further ado, let's get to it. Here we go. The History of the Great American Fortunes. We're back. All right, here we go. This is the final chapter on the Vanderbilt dynasty, I believe. I think it'll still pop up in other places, but let's do it. This is part 3, chapter 8, Further Aspects of the Vanderbilt Fortune. The juggling of railroads and the virtual seizure of coal mines were by no means the only accomplishments of the Vanderbilt family in the years under consideration. Colorless as was the third generation, undistinguished by any marked characteristic, extremely commonplace in its conventions, it yet proved itself a worthy successor of Commodore Vanderbilt. The lessons he had taught of how to appropriate wealth were duly followed by his descendants, and all of the ancestral methods were closely adhered to by the third generation. Whatever might be its pretensions to a certain integrity and to a profound respectability, there was really no difference between its methods and those of the Commodore. Times had changed, that was all. What had once been regarded as outright theft and piracy were now cloaked under high-sounding phrases as, quote, corporate extension, unquote, and, quote, high finance, unquote, and other catchwords calculated to lull public suspicion and resentment. A refinement of phraseology had set in, and it served its purpose. Concomitantly, while executing the transactions already described, the Vanderbilts of the third generation put through many others, both large and small, which converted into further heaps of wealth. An enumeration of all these diverse frauds would necessitate a tiresome presentation. A few examples will suffice. The small frauds were but lesser in relation to the larger. At this period of the economic development of the country, when immense thefts were being consummated, a fraud had to rise to the dignity of at least $50 million to be regarded as a large one. The law, it is true, prescribed any theft involving more than $25 as grand larceny, but it was law applying to the poor only, and operative on them exclusively. The inordinately rich were beyond all law. seeing that they could either manufacture it or its interpretation at will. Among the conspicuous, audacious capitalists, the fraud of a few paltry million shrank to the modesty of a small, cursory, offhand operation. Yet, in the aggregate, these petty frauds constituted great results, and, for that reason, were valued accordingly. Oh yeah, he's really laying into it now about these, how these people just basically stole and got away with impunity, you know? $25 if you stole anything to that value? Grand larceny. But here he's saying, like, you know, if you weren't pulling off some kind of fraud worth at least $50 million, it was hardly respectable. I mean, it could hardly be considered large, some kind of large fraud. If it wasn't for $50 million, you're like, you're in the bush leagues, you know? Continuing with the book here. An $8 million area confiscated. Such a slight fraud was, for instance, the Vanderbilt's confiscation of an entire section of New York City. In 1887, they decided that they had urgent and particular need for railroad yard purposes of a sweep of streets from 60th Street to 72nd Street along the Hudson River Railroad Division. What if this property had been bought, laid out, and graded by the city at considerable expense? The Vanderbilts resolved to have it and get it for nothing. Under special forms of law dictated by them, they thereupon took it. The method was absurdly easy. Ever compliant to their interests and composed, as usual, of men retained by them or responsive to their influences, the legislature of 1887 passed an act compelling the city authorities to close up the required area of streets. Then the city officials, fully as accommodating, turned the property over to the exclusive and practically perpetual use of the New York Central and Hudson River Railroad. With the profusest expressions of regard for the public interests, the railroad officials did not in the slightest demur at signing an agreement with the municipal authorities. In this paper, they pledged themselves to cooperate with the city in conferring upon the Board of Street Openings the right to reopen any of the streets at any time. This arrangement was but a decoy for immediate popular effect. No such reopening ordinance was ever passed. The streets remained closed to the public, which, theoretically at least, was left with the title. In fact, the memorandum of the agreement strangely disappeared from the Corporation Council's office and did not turn up until 20 years later, when it was accidentally and most mysteriously discovered in the Lenox Library. Whence came it to this curious repository? The query remains unanswered. Oh yeah, so nobody knew what was going on because they lost the title or the memorandum of understanding between them. And then 20 years later, it wound up in a library. Continuing on. For 17 and a half acres of this confiscated land, comprising about 350 city lots, later valued at around $8 million, the New York Central and Hudson River Railroad did not pay a cent in rental or taxes after the Act of 1887 was passed. On the island of Manhattan alone, 70,000 poor families were every year evicted for inability to pay rent, a continuous and horribly tragic event well worth comparing with the preposterous facility with which the great possessing classes everywhere either bought or defied law and confiscated when it suits them. So cunningly drafted was the Act of 1887 that while New York City was obliged to give the exclusive use of this large stretch of property to the company, yet the title to the property, the empty name, remained vested in the city. This being so, a corporation council complacently decided that the railroad company could not be taxed so long as the city owned the title. Footnote number one. And in footnote number one here, Gus Myers notes that this information comes from the minutes of the New York City Board of Estimate and Apportionment, The Financial and Franchise Matters of 1907, page 1071 to 1085. It will thus be seen, reported Harry P. Nichols, last name N-I-C-H-O-L-S, engineer in charge of the Franchise Bureau, quote, that the railroad is at present, and has been for 20 years, occupying more than 300 city lots, or something less than 20 acres, without compensation to the city, unquote. All right, so there you go. Continuing on with the book. Another of what may be called, for purposes of distinction, the numerous small depredations at this time was the foisting upon New York City the cost of replacing the New York Central's masonry viaduct approaches with a fine steel elevated system. This fraud cost the public treasury about $1,200,000, quite a sizable sum, it will be admitted, but one nevertheless of pitiful proportions in comparison with previous and later transactions of the Vanderbilt family. We have seen how, in 1872, Commodore Vanderbilt put through the legislature an act forcing New York City to pay $4 million for improving the railroad's roadway on Park Avenue. His grandsons now repeated his method. In 1892, the United States government was engaged in dredging a ship canal through the Harlem River. The Secretary of War, having jurisdiction of all navigable waters, issued a mandate to the New York Central to raise its bridge to a given height so as to permit the passing under of large vessels. To comply with this order, it was necessary to raise the track structure both north and south of the Harlem River. Had an ordinary citizen, upon receiving an order from the authorities to make improvements or alterations in his property, attempted to compel the city to pay all or any part of the cost, he would have been laughed at or summarily dealt with. The Vanderbilts were not ordinary property holders. Oh, no, no, sir. Having the power to order legislatures to do their bidding, they now proceeded to imitate their grandfather and compel the city to pay the greater portion of the cost of supplying them with a splendid steel elevated structure. So here it is again and again. They pretty much defrauded the city out of 20 acres, essentially. Lost some paperwork and called it good enough. Oh, and then they didn't have to pay taxes. This was kind of interesting because the way the legislation was drafted, and I'm sure this happens all the time, they turned over the property to the company, but the title was still held by the city. So, of course, the Corporation Commission said, oh, well, you know, they don't have to pay taxes. They're not the owner of the property, even though they are essentially using it for free, and it's closed off from the public. And now they're, you know, the federal government's coming in and messing with their properties, telling them they have to raise their bridge over the river. And so they are going to get a law passed, I'm sure. Here we go. Public taxation to supply private capital. The legislature of 1892 was thoroughly responsive. This was a legislature which was not merely corrupt, but brazenly and frankly so, as was proved by the scandalous openness with which various spoliative measures were rushed through. An act was passed compelling New York City to pay one half of the cost of the projected elevated approaches up to the sum of $1,600,000. New York City was thus forced to pay $800,000 for constructing that portion south of the Harlem River. If, so the law read on, the cost exceeded the estimate of $800,000, then the New York Central was to pay the difference. Additional provision was made for the compelling of New York City to pay for the building of the section north of the Harlem River. But who did the work of contracting and building, and who determined what the cost was? Why, the railroad company itself. It charged what it pleased for materials and work and had complete control of the disbursing of the appropriations. The city's supervising commission had, perforce, to accept its arbitrary demands and lacked all power to question or even scrutinize its reports of expenditures. Apart from the New York Central's officials, no one knows what the actual cost was except as stated by the company. Wow, that's unreal. They were never audited. They got the money and then they dispersed it and they paid themselves to do all the work. Yeah, that's pretty bad. That's why we have a lot of these ethics things now about bidding on contracts and stuff like that. I mean, we still see it violated today, no doubt about it. You know, no big contracts, stuff like that. But there's a reason all this stuff came about. It wasn't just, you know, the government was like, oh, you know, we have to do this because it'll annoy some people. No, I mean, obviously they have their own schemes. They like to get more power. They love to, giving contracts to people means more money for them, more influence. But some of this stuff did come about, I'm sure, at first with good intentions, you know. Because you had stuff like this, where the company basically defrauded the government, and nobody knows how much this project really cost. Because the railroad company took the money from the government, they dispersed it to themselves, and they never kept any records and were never audited. So they did all the construction, they said, oh, hey, you know, like, this piece of wood here cost $150, or whatever, you know what I mean? They bought all the supplies, they told themselves what it was costing, and then they paid themselves from the city's money. It's unbelievable scam. Unbelievable. Continuing on. South of the Harlem River, this reported cost was $800,000. North of the Harlem River, $400,000. At practically no expense to themselves, the Vanderbilts obtained a massive four-track elevated structure running for miles over the city streets. The people of the city of New York were forced to bear a compulsory taxation of $1,200,000 without getting the slightest equivalent for it. The Vanderbilts own these elevated approaches absolutely. Not a cent's worth of claim or title have the people in them. Together with the $4 million of public money extorted by Commodore Vanderbilt in 1872, this sum of $1.2 million makes a total amount of $5,200,000 plucked from the public treasury under form of law to make improvements in which the people who have footed the bill have not a moiety of ownership. Footnote number 2. The Vanderbilts have capitalized these terminal approaches as though they had been built with private money. Footnote number 3. And in footnote number 3, Gus Myers notes, because this is something we've seen before, that they overcapitalized this stuff, right? Remember we talked about watering stock fraud, securities fraud? Well, this is what they're doing, except now, remember, this stuff has been... these improvements have been built by the public's money, so they have no ownership, really. It was a gift to them, but they're still capitalizing it as if they had built it and owned it. So in footnote number 3, Myers notes, the New York Central has long compelled the New York, New Haven, and Hartford Railroad to pay 7 cents toll for every passenger transported south of Woodlawn, and also 1/3 of the maintenance cost, including interest of the terminal. In reporting an effort of the New York, New Haven, Hartford Railroad to have these terms modified, the New York Times stated in its financial columns, issue of December 25, 1908, quote, as matters now stand, the New Haven, without its consent, is forced to bear 1/3 of the charge arising from the increased capital invested in the Central's terminal, unquote. When in 1931 the New York Central Railroad Company applied to the Public Service Commission for a 40% increase in commutation fares, it gave as a main ground the valuation of its terminal property. The total value of the Grand Central Terminal Zone extending to 59th Street, it valued at $84,000,000 $335,726. Nowhere, however, either in the application or in the hearings, was the fact brought out that considerable of the funds used to provide the company with its terminal and approaches into the city were public funds, the proceeds of mandatory taxation. All right, so there you go. Let's continue on with the book here. At this point, a significant note may be made in passing. While these and other huge frauds were going on, Cornelius Vanderbilt was conspicuously presenting himself as a most ardent, quote-unquote, reformer in politics. He was, for instance, a distinguished member of the Committee of 70, organized in 1894 to combat and overthrow Tammany corruption. Such as we have repeatedly observed was the quality of some of the men who composed the reform movements. They won applause and respectability by virtuously denouncing petty, vulgar political corruption, which they themselves often instigated, and thus they diverted attention from their own extensive rascality. Oh yeah. A multitude of acquisitions. Why tempt exhaustion by lingering upon a multitude of other operations which went to increase the wealth and possessions of the Vanderbilt family? One after another, often several simultaneously, they were put through, sometimes surreptitiously, again with overt effrontery. Legislative measures in New York and many other states were drafted with such skill that sly provisions allowing the greatest frauds were concealed in the enactments, and the first knowledge that the plundered public frequently had of them was after they had already been accomplished. These frauds comprised corrupt laws that gave, in circumstances of notorious scandal, tracts of land in the Adirondack Mountains to railroad companies included in the Vanderbilt system. They embraced laws, and still more laws, exempting this or that stock or property from taxation, and laws making presents of valuable franchises and allowing further consolidations. Laws were enacted in New York State, the effects of which were to destroy the Erie Canal, which has cost the people of New York State $100 million, as a competitor of the New York Central Railroad. All of these and many other measures will be skimmed over by a simple reference and attention focused on a particularly large and notable transaction by which William K. Vanderbilt, in 1898, added about $50 million to his fortune at one superb swoop. Alright, and so just that sentence there about the Erie Canal, it's worded a little confusing, because he puts in some parenthetical stuff there, but basically he's saying that there was a law enacted in New York State, which at its bottom line was to destroy the Erie Canal because it was a competitor of Vanderbilt's New York Central Railroad. All right, got that? Let's continue on here. The Vanderbilt ownership of various railroad systems had been of an intricate, roundabout nature. A group of railroads, the majority of the stock of which was actually owned by the Vanderbilt family, were nominally put under the ownership of different and apparently distinct railroad companies. This devious arrangement was intended to conceal the real ownership and to have a plausible claim in counteracting the charge that many railroads were concentrated in one ownership and were combined in monopoly in restraint of trade. The plan ran thus. The Vanderbilts owned the New York Central and Hudson River Railroad. In turn, this railroad, as a corporation, owned the greater part of the $50 million of stock of the Lakeshore Railroad. The Lakeshore, in turn, owned the control or a chief share of the control of other railroads and thus on. In 1897, William K. Vanderbilt began clandestinely campaigning to combine the New York Central and the Lakeshore under one definite, centralized management. This plan was one in strict harmony with the trend of the times, and it had the undoubted advantage of promising to save large sums in managing expenses. But this anticipated retrenchment was not the main incentive. A dazzling opportunity was presented of checking in an immense amount of loot. The grandson again followed his eminent grandfather's teachings. His plan was nothing more than a repetition of what the old Commodore had done in his consolidations. During the summer and fall of 1897, the market gymnastics of Lakeshore stock were cleverly manipulated. By the declaration of a 7% dividend, the market price of the stock was run up from 115 to about 200. The object of this manipulation was to have a justification for issuing $100 million and 3.5% New York Central bonds to buy $50 million of Lakeshore 7% capital stock. By his personal manipulation, William K. Vanderbilt at the same time ballooned the price of the New York Central stock. The purpose was kept a secret until shortly before the plan was consummated on February 4, 1898. On that day, William K. Vanderbilt and his subservient directors of the New York Central gathered their corpulent and corporate persons about one table and voted to buy the Lakeshore stock. With due formalities, they then adjourned and, moving over to another table, declared themselves in meeting as directors of the Lakeshore Railroad and solemnly voted to accept the offer. I see how that works. Yeah, just change tables. It's the ultimate spy thing. Yeah, today you're one person and 10 minutes later you're another person. Because don't forget, that's what corporations are. They are persons. Presently, however, an awkward and slightly annoying defect was discovered. It turned out that the stock corporation law of New York State specifically prohibited the bonded indebtedness of any corporation being more than the value of the capital stock. This discovery was not disconcerting. The obstacle could easily be overcome with some well-distributed generosity. A bill was quickly drawn up to remedy the situation and hurried to the legislature, then in session at Albany. The assembly balked and ostentatiously refused to pass it. But after the lapse of a short time, the assembly saw a great new light and rushed it through on March 3rd, on which same day it passed the Senate. It was at this precise time that a certain noted lobbyist at Albany somehow showed up, it was alleged, with a fund of $500,000, and members of the Assembly and Senate suddenly revealed evidences of being unusually flush with money. Footnote number 4. A lot of alleged there, I gotta say. Come on, Gus. What a coincidence. So this infamous lobbyist shows up with $500K and suddenly all the members of the Senate have just like bundles of money coming out of their pockets. And in footnote number 4 about this, these unbelievable allegations, I'm shocked. Shocked, I tell you.
I'm shocked. Shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
You're winning, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. Everybody out at once.
In footnote number 4, Gus Myers notes that the author was so informed by an official who represented New York City's legal interests at this session and successive legislative sessions, and who was thoroughly conversant with every move. See Chapter 80, The Laws of 1898, The Laws of New York, 1898, Volume 2, page 142. The amendment declared that Section 24 of the Stock Corporation Law did not apply to any railroad corporations. Okay, so there you go. That's how he did it. Just a little bit of grease for the wheels. and you too can be an industrial magnate. A super patriot of the country. Continuing now with the book. A very illuminating transaction, surely, and well-deserving of philosophic comment. This, however, will be eschewed, and attention next turned to the manner in which the Vanderbilts in 1899 obtained control of the Boston and Albany Railroad. The Boston and Albany Railroad becomes theirs. To a great extent, this railroad had been built with public funds raised by enforced taxation. The city of Albany contributing $1 million and the state of Massachusetts $4.3 million of public funds. Originally, it looked as if the public interests were fully conserved. But gradually, little by little, predatory corporate interests got in their delicate work and induced successive legislatures and state officials to betray the public interests. The public holdings of stock were entirely subordinated so that, in time, a private corporation secured the practical ownership. And that should be just absolutely illustrative for anything that happens today in America. It's, they always pass something for the good of the public, right? For the public's great benefit. But, pretty much see how over time, and especially again here, Myers is laying this out for you over 100 years ago. This man was telling you how the game was played. These things get passed originally for the public's benefit. That's the package that's slapped on it. And sure, they might function that way for a while. Like I'm sure the SEC for a while fought against fraud and securities fraud and stuff like that. And I'm sure the FDA for a while prevented all these adulterated products and hazardous and deleterious stuff from being sold on the markets. And things like this, you know, I'm sure that's how it works in the beginning, but as it goes, pretty much everything becomes corrupted after a little while, if it has anything to do with the government, because these people have owned the government forever, and the people in there are essentially their agents, and it's been, I don't know, anyways, I don't want to get too far off in this, but this is like, he's just laying it out over and over again. I mean, how many times in our history, do you have to see this happen until you realize, like, okay, this is how it works. I mean, it's got nothing to do, as we've looked at a ton of times before, it's got nothing to do with the system itself, you know. It's just this thing that the way it works is it's the government creates the corporations, and then the corporations staff the government ranks. So it's just a continuing circle nonstop, and it doesn't matter if it's capitalist system or a socialist system. I mean, you could argue that we're kind of operating under all sorts of different systems here in America. I think everybody has a good point. You know, some people note that it's, you know, oh yes, it's the capitalist system. That's the common one. Some people will say, well, no, look, we're living under a socialist or communist type system, because look at all these planks of the manifesto that have been fulfilled. And they got a bit of a point there. Some people say, oh, no, it's a fascist system because the corporations run everything. I think everybody kind of makes a good point. You can extract features of each system that we've kind of put into this giant melting pot, and this is what we've come out with, but I think it's so interesting how he just paints this picture over and over again. And in all different ways, too. I mean, we've looked at national government stuff. We looked at local and state government stuff. Myers really knew his stuff when it came to New York. And you can just see how this, as a railroad is built with public funds, it was going to be great. It's going to travel people all over from Boston to Albany. You know, it's going to be amazing. And slowly but surely, it turned out, well, that's not the way it's going to work. But anyways, let's continue on with the book here. I want to get a bunch more in before I have to cut this out. Finally, in 1899, the legislature of Massachusetts effaced the last vestige of state ownership by giving the Vanderbilts a perpetual lease of this richly profitable railroad for a scant $2 million payment a year. During the debate over this act, Representative Dean charged in the legislature that, quote, "It is common rumor in the State House that members are receiving $300 apiece for their votes," unquote. The acquisition of this railroad enabled the New York Central to make direct connection with Boston and with much of the New England coast and added about 400 miles to the Vanderbilt system. To pay interest and dividends on the hundreds of millions of dollars of inflated bonds and stock which three generations of the Vanderbilts had issued, and to maintain and enhance their value, it was necessary to keep on increasingly extorting revenues. The sources of the profits were palpable. Time after time, freight rates were raised, as was more than sufficiently proved in various official investigations, despite denials. Conjunctively with this process, another method of extortion was the ceaseless one of beating down the wages of the workers to the very lowest point at which they could be hired. While the Vanderbilts and other magnates were manufacturing law at will, and boldly appropriating under sanction of law colossal possessions in real and personal property, how was the law, as embodied in legislatures, officials, and courts, acting towards the working class? The government, an engine of tyranny. Ooh, hello, Gus. Coming out and calling in just like that. Bam, engine of tyranny. The grievances and protests of the workers aroused no response save the ever-active one of contumely, coercion, and violent reprisals. The treasury of nation, state, and cities, raised by compulsory taxation, falling heavily upon the workers, was at all times at the complete disposal of the propertied interests, who emptied it as fast as it was filled. The propertyless and jobless were left to starve. To them, no helping arm was outstretched, and if they complained, no quarter given. The state as an institution, while supported by the toil of the producers, was wholly of a capitalist state, with the capitalists in complete supremacy to fashion and use it as they chose. They used the state political machinery to plunder the masses, and then, at the slightest tendency on the part of the workers to resist these crushing injustices and burdens, called upon the state to hurry out its armed forces to repress this dangerous discontent. In Buffalo in 1890 and 1891, 31 in every 100 destitutes were impoverished because of unemployment, and in New York City, 29 in every 100. Footnote number 5. Hundreds of millions of dollars of public funds were given outright to the capitalists, but not a cent appropriated to provide work for the unemployed. In the panic of 1893, when millions of men, women, and children were out of work, the machinery of government, national, state, and municipal proffered not the least aid, but, on the contrary, sought to suppress agitation and prohibit meetings by flinging the leaders into jail. Basing his conclusions upon the Aldrich United States Senate Report of 1893, a report highly favorable to capitalist interests, and not unexpectedly so, since Senator Aldrich was the recognized senatorial mouthpiece of the great vested interests, Spahr found that the highest daily wage for all earners, taken in a mass, was $2.04. Footnote number 6. And that man's name Spahr, his last name S-P-A-H-R. More than three-quarters of all the railroad employees in the United States received less than $2 a day. Large numbers of railroad employees were forced to work from 12 to 14 hours a day, and their efficiency and stamina thus lowered. Periodically, many were laid off in enforced idleness, and appalling numbers were maimed or killed in the course of duty. Footnote number 7. injured or slain largely because the railroad corporations refused to expend money in the introduction of improved automatic coupling devices. These workers or their heirs were next confronted by what? The unjust and oppressive provisions of worthless employers' liability laws drafted by corporation attorneys in such a form that the worker or his family generally had almost no claim. The very judges deciding these suits were, as a rule, put on the bench by the railroad corporations. Machine guns for the overworked! Now, I highly doubt this is a program that actually gives them machine guns, more like they get the bullets that come out of the end of the machine gun. That's what I'm guessing. These deadly conditions prevailed on the Vanderbilt railroads even more than on any others. It was notorious that the Vanderbilt system was not only managed in semi-antiquated ways so far as the operation was concerned, but also that its trainmen were terribly underpaid and overworked. In reply to a continued agitation for better hours on the part of the Vanderbilt employees, the New York legislature passed an act in 1892 which apparently limited the working hours of railroad employees to 10 a day. There was a gleam of sunshine, but lo, when the act was critically examined after it had become law, here we go, it was found that a quote-unquote little joker had been sneaked into its massive lawyer's terminology. The surreptitious clause ran to this effect. The railroad companies were permitted to exact from their employees overtime work for extra compensation. This practically made the whole law a negation. So it turned out, for in August 1892, the switchmen employed by various railroad lines converging at Buffalo struck for shorter hours and more pay. The strike spread and was meeting with tactical success. The strikers easily persuaded men who had been hired to fill their jobs to quit. What did the Vanderbilts and their allies now do? They fell back upon the old ruse of invoking armed force to suppress what they proclaimed to be violence. They who had bought law and had violated the law incessantly now represented that their property interests were endangered by, quote-unquote, mob violence, and prated of the need of soldiers to, quote, restore law and order, unquote. It was a serviceable pretext and was immediately acted upon. The governor of New York State obediently ordered out the entire state militia, a force of 8,000, and dispatched it to Buffalo. The strikers were now confronted with bayonets and machine guns. The soldiery summarily stopped the strikers from picketing, that is to say, from attempting to persuade strikebreakers to refrain from taking their places. Against such odds, the strike was lost. If, however, the Vanderbilts could not afford to pay their workers a few cents more in wages a day, they could afford to pay millions of dollars for matrimonial alliances with foreign titles. The preliminaries were settled by lawyers. Footnote number 9. Aha, yes, good point, Gus, good point. They can't afford to pay their workers, you know, an extra 10 cents, 25 cents. But they can spend millions of million dollars marrying European nobles, can't they? Ugh. 10 millions for a dukedom. The announcement was made in 1895 that, quote, a marriage had been arranged, unquote, between Consuelo, a young daughter of William K. Vanderbilt, and the Duke of Marlborough. An affidavit filed in the surrogate's court at Riverhead, Long Island, 28 years later on March 13, 1923, revealed that at the time of the marriage, William K. Vanderbilt set aside $2,500,000 in the form of 50,000 shares of railroad stock as a trust fund, the income of which was to be paid to the Duke of Marlborough during his lifetime and to his heirs after his death. The affidavit was made to show that none of the assignments of money and stock made were in anticipation of death, a forestalling forbidden by the inheritance tax law. The marriage agreement, a long document dated November 6, 1895, began... I gotta do my noble voice here. Quote, "Between the most noble Charles Richard John, Duke of Marlborough, of Blenheim Palace in the county of Oxford, England, party of the first part, and William Kissam Vanderbilt of Oakland, in the county of Suffolk, New York, Esquire, of the second part, Consuelo Vanderbilt, party of the third part, and the Honorable Ivor Churchill, guest of Arlington Street in the county of Middlesex, England, and Mr. Vanderbilt, their trustees of the fourth part. Whereas a marriage is intended between the said Duke of Marlborough and the said Consuelo Vanderbilt, and whereas pursuant to an agreement made upon the treaty for the said intended marriage, the sum of $2,500,000 and 50,000 shares of the capital stock of the Beach Creek Railway Company, on which an annual payment of 4% is guaranteed by the New York Central Railroad Company, is transferred this day to the trustees, and shall, during the joint lives of the said Duke of Marlborough, Consuelo Vanderbilt, pay the income of the said sum of $2,500,000 unto the Duke of Marlborough for his life, and from and after the death of the said Duke of Marlborough shall pay the income of the said trust fund into the said Consuelo Vanderbilt for her life," unquote, etc., etc. Oh, man. Talk about a boring wedding document. I'm sure they slipped some rider in there, though. Never put it beyond a Vanderbilt. They write a marriage declaration somehow. Ooh, their whole estate is exempt from taxation or something, I'm sure. Ram it through there. Continuing on now. The wedding ceremony was one of showy splendor. Millions of dollars in gifts were lavished upon the couple. Other millions in cash went to rehabilitate and maintain Blenheim House with its prodigal cost of reconstruction, its retinue of 200 servants, and its annual expense roll of $100,000. Millions more flowed out from the Vanderbilt exchequer in defraying the cost of yachts and of innumerable appurtenances and luxuries. Not less than $2,500,000 was spent in building Sutherland House in London. Great as was this expense, it was not so serious as to perturb the Duchess's father. His $50 million feat of financial legerdemain in 1898 alone far more than made up for these extravagant outlays. The Marlborough title was an expensive one. It turned out to be a better thing to retain than the man who bore it. After a 13 years compact, the couple decided to separate for good and sufficient reasons. Okay. And I just want to go back here, and I want to give you the definition of legerdemain, because I had to look that up, and dictionary.com says that few people likely know this word, and it means sleight of hand or trickery or deception. So, that's what they're talking about. Cool. Continuing on with the book. The sequel, it may be interpolated here, came in 1926, when the Duchess of Marlborough obtained from the Catholic Diocesan Court at Southwark, England, a decree annulling the marriage. On that occasion, she, in an interview published in The People of London, vigorously denied any imputation that she had been forced into a loveless marriage because of the social aspiration of her parents. She said, quote, "I may have been a little romantic, and consequently over-enthusiastic at the time, but I want you to be clear that the step was mine, and that I alone was responsible for it. Disillusionment came soon, and probably I paid for my girlish enthusiasm. But that again is my business and does not concern the public. Unquote. Under the ironclad provisions of the marriage contract, Marlboro, it was reported, had received $3,100,000, and notwithstanding the marriage annulment, he was receiving $100,000 annually. However, Consuelo Vanderbilt had a fortune independent of him. Gladys Vanderbilt, a daughter of Cornelius, likewise allied herself with a title by marrying in 1908 Count Laszlo Szczęski.
I don't know how the hell to pronounce that. Let me just spell it. His first name, Laszlo, that's L-A-S-O-L-O.
Last name, S-Z-E-C-H-E-N-Y-I. So, good luck with trying to pronounce that. Count Laszlo, a sprig of the Hungarian feudal nobility. The wedding, naively reported a scribe, quote, was characterized by elegant simplicity, and was witnessed by only 300 relatives and intimate friends of the bride and bridegroom. The elegant simplicity consisted of gifts, the value of which was estimated at fully $1,000,000, and a costly ceremony. If the bride had beauty and the bridegroom wit, no mention of them was made. The one fact conspicuously emphasized was the all-important one of the bride having a fortune in her own right of about $12,000,000. The precise sum which made the court eager to share his title, no one knew except the parties to the transaction. Her father had died in 1899, leaving a fortune nominally reaching about $100,000,000. Its actual proportions were much greater. It had long been customary on the part of the very rich, as the New York State Board of Tax Commissioners pointed out in 1903, to evade the inheritance tax in advance by various fraudulent devices. One of these was to enclose stocks or money in envelopes and apportion them among the heirs, either at the deathbed or by subsequent secret delivery. Footnote number 10. Like his father, Cornelius Vanderbilt had died of apoplexy. In his will, he had cut off his eldest son, Cornelius, with but a puny $1,000,000, and the reason for this paternal sternness? He had disapproved of Cornelius's choice of marriage. To his son, Alfred, the unrelenting multimillionaire left the most of his fortune, with a showering of many millions upon his widow, upon Reginald, another son, and upon his two daughters. Cornelius objected to the injustice and hardship of being left a beggar with but a scanty million, and threatened a legal contest, whereupon Alfred, pitying the dire straits to which brother Cornelius had been reduced, presented him with 6 or 7 millions with which to ease the biting pangs of want. Marriages with titled foreigners proved a drain upon the Vanderbilt fortune. The American marriages, on the other hand, contracted by this family, interlinked other great fortunes with theirs. One of those Vanderbilt buds, Gertrude, in 1896, married Harry Payne Whitney, whose father, William C. Whitney, had left a large fortune. All right. And I think I'm going to cut it there for today. We'll pick it up next time. It's hot and I got stuff to do. So, yeah, I'm going to cut there. Title nobilities, it looks like. Sounds like those Europeans needed a bailout or something. So they kept getting married to these American industrialists. Pretty interesting.
As always, you've been listening to the History of America's 1% podcast, where we have been reading from the 1910 classic by Gustavus Myers, The History of the Great American Fortunes. And as always, this is the information that you should know, but you're not supposed to.
Have you seen me at the window, baby? I've been staring while you dine. You can't blame me for the burning eyes when I see you spitting out your wine. You say you never mistreat me, baby, and I guess that suits me fine. Say you're just slimming down for the season, honey, while I'm dying on the vine. Is there something very wrong here? It's been wrong for such a long, long time. Can't you hear me at the window, baby? Can't you see me on the line? Is there something very, very wrong here? And it's been wrong for such a long, long time. Can't you see?
Against such odds, the strike was lost. Oh, there's some happy news. Oh, no, wait, that's not happy news. What the f*** am I talking about?